Welcome to Cowboy Church with your host, Russ Weaver, and Susie McIntyre. So sit back and enjoy some good singing, some great testimony, and some good preaching. Welcome to Cowboy Church.
Hi, I'm Susie McIntyre.
And I'm Russ Weaver.
You need to stand by for a wonderful Cowboy Church. Testimonies, songs, a great sermon. We're in so many neat places, Russ. Isn't it exciting to be a part of Cowboy Church?
Absolutely. And what I really like about it is I never know exactly what I'm going to say.
Well, that's kind of the way it is, isn't it?
It is. Stay tuned. We're going to figure it out, though. We promise.
This is a song that Paul Overstreet wrote a few years ago. And that's my prayer in my life. You know, when we get our age, some of us, a little over the halfway mark, we want to make it count. Hungry for the good life all the days of my youth. I placed my plans and dreams before you. But now's the time to build again, and this time on your truth. Whatever you ask of me, I'll do. Won't you teach me, Lord, to seek your face, not just the works of your hand. In perfect submission, undertake the great commission you have planned. And though I long to see the many wonders that your hands can do, first I must learn to follow you. Standing at another crossroad in my life, wondering how the plans have all gone wrong. I realized I was the maker of my own strife. And where did my priorities go wrong? Won't you teach me, Lord, to seek your face, not just the work of your hand. In perfect submission, undertake the great commission you have planned. And though I long to see the many wonders that your hands can do, first I must learn to follow. First, I must learn to follow you. Teach me, Lord, to follow you. Mm-hmm. Amen. How many of y'all are married? Got families? Married, families, keep them up, keep them up. How many of y'all can truthfully say that you got here this morning without any arguments or any strife? Wow, give yourselves a big hand clap. Wonderful, wonderful. Well, this is a song that talks about marriage, and I don't know about y'all, but Sunday morning was always the big test for our family. If anything went wrong, it was on Sunday morning. It was like, I can't even get there. I don't even want to go. At this rate. Wasn't it wonderful when you touched the doorknob on the church house, your whole disposition changed. You went from, I hate your guts, to, oh, everything's wonderful. Isn't God good? So this is a song that you can just let down and we'll be all right with all of it, right? Turn to your neighbor and say, you know she's absolutely right.
Sometimes love's good times couldn't be better, and the bad times couldn't get worse. And sometimes we gently whisper, and other times we scream and shout. But honey, when the smoke clears, we always seem to work things out. And we're closer than ever, safer in each other's arms. That's what you get for holding. Holding on. Man, it'd be a good time to reach around your wife and give her a big old snuggle up. Now sometimes I lean on you, and sometimes you lean on me. We share the good and bad times. Well, that's what lovers do. And even when we wanna call it quits and head for the door, we stay. Jumping on the bed, and then there were always those times you'd get hurt right in the midst of it. You know what my mama used to say? Y'all know it. That's what you get. That's what you get. In southeastern Oklahoma, you don't say get, it's get. You get? Come on.
Well, they say what doesn't break you will only make you strong.
We learn. That's what you get. If you sow love, you're going to reap love. If you sow that joy we were talking about a few minutes ago, you're going to reap that joy. If you sow the goodness, patience, kindness that God tells us about, all of that's going to come right back to you.
Just to catch everybody up, I've had a few people ask, and let me just give you, I'll take just 2 minutes and kind of catch you guys up on where I've been. We launched the church there in Central Oregon in 2012, and we are experiencing some cool stuff with people from outside the church, people who have never considered themselves church people. I was just telling them a minute ago, we had a guy come to Bible study all excited because he discovered the verse John 3:16 and wanted to know if we'd read it. And then you kind of feel sort of conflicted because on one hand, you want to be like, yeah, I've heard of it. Have you ever been to a sporting event? But then on the other hand, how cool is that to see someone who had never even read that find a place in church and find a home there? And so we're bumping right at 1,000 every holiday, about 500 on the weekends. But let me tell you what we're doing with the cattle project. And you've heard me talk about it. You guys have actually participated in it. We've had cattle here on the property here for almost a year in the back. We have taken up this cattle project to feed our communities. And the way we've said that is that we want to see God unite our culture. Because here's the thing, we've got a lot of resources in the community, but not everybody in the community considers themselves to be church people. And so we raise rope and cattle, we've got events and brandings and jackpots, and we lease them out, and they go kind of make a living for the first portion of their career. And then on the back half of that, all the heifers will go back on bulls, and that's where we'll get our calves and our steers, then we're just donating them to the food banks. And instead of just donating directly from the church, what we're doing is we're plugging them into programs that are already active in the community, St. Vincent de Paul, Redemption House, Bethlehem Inn, things like this. We provided all the food for the Veterans Day in Prineville this year. We're providing beef for the Rodeo Bible Camp. And what we're seeing is that there are people in the community that go, hey, I'm not a church guy, I'm not a church person, but if you're giving cows to the community, that's something we can understand. We've got an outspoken atheist that regularly donates hay to the church. Because, and so we believe that'll be the, yeah, yeah. And so I want to make sure, I mean, I'm going to say thank you, even though you may or may not have known that you guys are participating in that. We've got right at 100 head right now on the very, very back part of the property that just sold. And so you guys have played a role in that. We donated about 1,500 pounds of hamburger to John Stout with Mercy Chefs. It's just cool. It's cool to see God take a culture of people that will unite behind a cause and sort of put an arrow on that and let people get involved with that. So thank you guys for what you're doing. That's literally my entire spiel. Have you guys, and this is going to sound really bizarre, but if you'll follow me for a second, I think it'll start to make sense. Have you guys ever caught yourself just looking at the stars? And I don't mean like, oh, yeah, there's stars out. Great. I mean, like, have you ever just stopped? I remember when I was a little kid laying on the ground and looking at the stars and thinking, they tell us in school, and I've never been to a star, but they tell us that it's like its own sun. You know, that our sun, that's the star that we're closest to. And if you look at all those stars and how big those are, that they all represent their own little thing. And pretty soon, if you're not careful, you can just get sort of taken with, like, I am tiny.
Right.
I am so small. Like, my existence is just so, on the scope of the world, is so small. You guys ever had that moment?
Oh, yeah.
When I ask you this question, here's what I believe. I'm gonna ask you a question, and you're going to hear the question, and it'll be one of two things. Oh, yeah, yeah, I've heard that. But it's one of those questions, if you really stop and soak on it, what I believe will happen is the same thing that happens when you look at stars for too long. Have you ever stopped and said, what does God see when he looks at me? Yeah, yeah, he loves me, and I'm his kid, and stuff like that. There's stars in the sky. But if you really stop and go, wait a minute, what does God actually see? Because he's God, and he doesn't just see me, he sees directly through me. And then his word tells us this, and this is a sort of a good verse, I guess. Unless you think about it for too long, and then it's a very uncomfortable verse. But it says, Matthew 10:29, it says, are not two sparrows sold for a penny, yet not one of them will fall to the ground outside of your Father's care. So that means this. That means that God doesn't just see you. That means that he always sees you. Now, here's what you want to avoid, because that starts to sound like a Christmas song. You remember the, he knows when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake, he spies on you every second, don't screw up or you don't get anything? I don't remember the exact words, but it's something like that. It says God is always watching you. You're like, oh, because I know what I've been doing. What does God see? What about the imperfections? What about the screw-ups? What about this? I remember believing, like, God can look at me as forgiven, like, before I got saved. Some of you guys are like, oh, no, he's going there. What about this? What does God see when he looks at me? Because I know that I've had screw-ups even when I've known better. Times that I've doubted. Sometimes I've been fearful. There are times where I just get so caught up in my circumstances. Have you ever had a moment like this? Maybe I'm alone. Maybe I'm not. Have you ever had a moment like this where, like, am I even a Christian? How does somebody who's a Christian that's supposed to be following Jesus go through what I'm going through, whether it's sin or doubt or fear or, like, existing, even something Christians are supposed to go to? So I'm going to ask you again, what does God see when he looks at you? It goes from, like, oh, I'm glad God sees me. If you're not careful, what can happen is, like, winter break times. When is he not watching? Let me tell you about a little dog. This is not my notes. You guys are going to get, this is a free analogy. I've got a little dog, and she's awesome. She's a hanging tree, and she bites. I've joked before that I should have named her Claire, because she gives free nose, lip, and ear piercings. She is a beast. And we raise horn cattle, and horn cattle are really hard on dogs, and she's really hard on them. And it is fun to watch. But every now and then, she is just so eat up with it. She's like owning a pet coyote. She never, like, looks you right in the eye. She's always just kind of like. But every now and then, she gets just so excited with what she's doing. She just gets to running. And pretty soon, like, you can be yelling at her. Not going to work. And I fell for that trap for a while. I'm like, run! Nothing makes me madder faster than a dog that won't come back when it knows to come back. I've chased her on the four-wheeler. I've given her spankings. But I think there are times where, because I feel like I'm on the outs with God, because I feel like I've already screwed up, because I feel like I'm just sort of at odds, I haven't had my devotions, I haven't been, maybe my language hasn't been bad. I'll be completely honest, I've got pretty good language, but I've got not very good language for a preacher. Or I don't know if I'm allowed to admit that, my mom's in the room. But there are times you just get to live in life and you're going and all of a sudden you're like, oh man, if I go to God now, it's gonna be a spanking. Okay, I'm just going to take some time then. I'm already kind of in the midst of a runaway here. And I think it's because we go through times like that because we haven't really stopped and settled in our heart, what does God see when he sees me? I don't know if we've ever really examined that real closely, because I think if you examine the word and what God says about himself, we would have a better understanding of how God feels about us, not how we perceive that God feels about us. And let me tell you, there is a giant difference. I'm going to read you seven verses. At the end of those seven verses, what I'm going to do is I'm going to come back and I'm going to break down what's actually being said. I'm going to tell you a story that you've probably already heard, but hopefully when we go back through it, there's some more in there to learn than what you knew. Exodus 17, verse 1. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." You've heard this story. Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and our livestock die of thirst?" Then Moses cried out to the Lord and said, "What am I to do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me." The Lord answered Moses, "Go out in front of the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, take in your hand the staff which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and the water will come out of it for the people to drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the place Massah Meribah, because the Israelites quarreled, and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Okay, so this would be a real easy story to hear. Basically, the idea is they get where they're going. There's no water. The people were frustrated. God sends Moses to strike the rock. Water comes out, saves the day. At a surface level, remember in Sunday school, we learned this in Sunday school. Remember, everybody's in line, and they walk up with their little cup, and everybody gets a little bit of water because God struck the rock, and a spigot appeared? It's biblical, according to our Sunday school teachers. It's a true story, only as long as there's Velcro on the back of the character. Some of you grew up in Sunday school. I want to tell you what I learned about this story, because there is so much buried in those seven verses that at a glimpse you would miss. Because this is not a story about just God pouring some water on the ground so they'd have something to drink. It's actually a story in my mind that begins to spell out how God relates to people. If we can understand how God relates to people, it'll paint a clearer picture of how God relates to you. And if you understand how God relates to you, you'll have a better understanding of what does God see when he looks directly at you. Even in sin, even in screw-ups, even in times where you don't want to be around God, even in times where you're in a full-on red little dog runaway. Just a better framework. Okay, so the whole Israelite, here's the first verse. So the whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim. You know what Rephidim means? Rest. They camped at a place called Rest. So that means that they were traveling with an expectation. They were traveling, believing they were headed to a place of rest. They've been going across the desert. It's been hard. Their sandals are getting worn out. And they're carrying this expectation that says, oh, if we could just get to where we're going. Oh, have you ever said that? Oh, if I could just get this car paid off. Oh, if I could just get this. If I could just get that promotion at work. Oh, if I could just get through the school year. If I could just make it to summer. If I could just get my homework turned in. Hypothetically, I mean. If we can just get to this area of rest. There's a frustration that we as Americans have developed in the church. Now, if something's happened in the American culture, it makes sense that the American society and American culture would sort of seep into the church, and we wouldn't even recognize it because of how common it is outside the church. Well, let me tell you, one of the things that we struggle with in the American church is that we don't study the difference between a good life and good circumstances. We've combined the two. We have said that a good life equals good circumstances. We want good circumstances, and we actually bundle it up and package it, and we call it a prosperity gospel that says, if you come to Jesus, he'll give you a good life and good circumstances. But the problem with that is this. Follow me for a second. The suicide rates are the highest amongst the wealthiest. And there's a little kid that you see on a commercial that doesn't necessarily even have all of his limbs playing soccer in the street, and he looks happy. How do we get to a place where we can begin to separate what is a good life from good circumstances? And that's exactly where the children of Israel found themselves, as they were going to a place called rest, and they were excited, and there was expectations. The biggest problem to the American Christian is not the hard times that we have to face. It's not the hard circumstances. It's that they exist at all because we didn't expect it. We expected the hard times weren't going to come anymore because we signed on the dotted line, said something about the Jesus thing, it's going to make our circumstances better, and that's not even in the Word. So then when hard times happen, what happens? We experience a breakdown. We experience some sort of a failure. We don't get the promotion. A bill comes due, and what do we say? God, after all I've done. There's less laughter, but the laughter that's there is kind of... After all I've done, after all the effort I put in, and this is how I get repaid. Because we have set an expectation that God didn't give us. We have set the expectation, and it's exactly what we see the children of Israel. They said, wait a minute, this is our place of water. This is our place of rest, and there's no water. I live in a place where there's no water. I live in the high desert. You're not even allowed state law. You're not even allowed to capture water coming off your own roof. Like, water is a thing. So I understand how they get there and they're like, hey, Moses, this place of rest is terrible. But there was no water for the people to drink. So they said this. They quarreled with Moses, said, give us water to drink. And Moses went, you people are unbelievable. Well, you want me to make it rain? You realize what you're asking. Why'd he quarrel with me, and why'd he put the Lord to the test? He's saying, why do you continue to put God on trial? What they were saying is, oh, really? God's with us? Where's the water? Oh, really? Really? Christian? Yeah, doing good, going to church. I even volunteer. Do you know that I'm an usher? Why are my bills paid? Pastor us, make us. Oh, never mind. First rule of leadership. It's always somebody's fault. Verse 3. But the people were thirsty and they grumbled against Moses. And they said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt and make us and our children and our livestock die of thirst? That wasn't an accidental statement. If you remember, Pharaoh said, yeah, sure, children of Israel, you can go. Take all the men and you can go. And Moses had to campaign and fight to get the women and children and the livestock released also. That's where the 10 plagues came in. So they weren't just randomly saying it. That was a specific criticism of Moses. It's not good enough that you bring us out here to die. You also bring our women and children and our livestock.